morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Lane McFadden. I represent the Army Corps of Engineers and the United States Fish and Wildlife Service in this matter. With me at counsel's table is Christina Storrs from the Corps of Engineers and Doug Halsey, counsel for the interveners. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for a rebuttal. The District Court's opinion in this case, as well as the Sierra Club's briefs on appeal, focus on a handful of small technical matters and choices that were made that were always some of the factors going into the overall decision by the Corps to approve this permit. The District Court focused on selected pieces of evidence from the administrative record, without always addressing first the Corps' explanation of that evidence and its explanation of why it reached a different decision. Before we get into those details, some brief context of this permit and the process that went into approving it may be helpful to this Court. There's no dispute here that the purpose and need of the project, which is to provide a regional shopping mall and associated commercial enterprises for this market, is valid and was not challenged. There's no dispute that the Corps first looked at whether there were different sites other than this one where the project could be located. It considered 11 different alternatives, and none of them were deemed to be practicable. That decision's
not challenged. Let me talk about the alternatives. It seems to me that one of the most significant choices made by the developers in this case with respect to the potential CWA impact is how much parking is taken up. Is that right?
That's right, Your Honor. Yes.
All right. So there, I just have two questions about that. The first is, what rate of parking spaces for each 1,000 square feet is the appropriate one? This seems to generate the difference between some amount of parking and a larger amount of parking. And there were two letters from other developers which CCTC solicited, which suggested the 4.5 rather than 5 ratio. And there's no response in the papers below, in the Corps' explanation below to that, to the two other developers who said that all you needed was 4.5. What's your answer to whether they've appropriately considered that part of the information that was in the record?
Your Honor, that information is not explicitly addressed, as you said. Other information did suggest that for retail establishments, 5 spaces per 1,000 feet was the appropriate number. And a major issue, of course, in this case, as the Corps explains in its statement of findings, is that the composition of commercial enterprises at this particular complex is different. There are more restaurants, for example.
Well, that seems to be a separate issue, which I also want to ask you about. But the general decision to accept a 5 parking places rather than 4.5, which had a significant difference in the way in how much of the wetlands is paved, it seems if two other developers who this developer actually solicited said 4.5 is the right number, that to not respond to that is to fail to respond to a significant comment.
Well, Your Honor, those comments, of course, go to an issue that the Corps did say overall was important. But to say that this is a significant comment that could, in and of itself, change the composition of the project, I think might be overstating the impact of those.
Is it wrong to say that it would be a significantly different amount of paving of wetlands if it was only 4.5 per 1,000 square feet than if it was 5?
It would be less pavement, yeah. Which would be less wetlands impact.
Right.
Whether that's significant, of course, is a term of art here.
Well, the Corps could have said that below. We don't think this is a material difference, but they didn't. This is something their lawyer is, by implication, suggesting from the podium.
And was asked about.
This wasn't raised below. It wasn't responded to below then. With respect to the restaurants, they said that the 8.08% ratio couldn't be further reduced and still meet the requirements of retailers, right? That was the basis of the decision below, right?
That's correct.
And but there was nothing in the record from any of the actual retailers, Target or any of the others that were referred to with respect to the parking, who said that, was there?
No, Target and the other retailers gave specific parking requirements, design and number of spaces
They didn't say anything about the restaurant ratio.
No, that's right. The restaurant ratio came from not from specific restaurant corporations, but instead from industry publications describing the need for additional parking at Deer's restaurants. And those publications suggested somewhere between 10 and 20 spaces per 1,000 feet of restaurant space were necessary.
So the only one I found is an industry report showing that modern, quote, lifestyle centers, which I take it this is, averaged 11.3% restaurants. That seems like a pretty general, broad statement from which to reach the conclusion. That is, that's the average. There's no statement that this one is necessary. There's no statement from the retailers who would want to be at this mall that they need that percentage of restaurants in order to attract customers, or nothing like that. This is just a general, and I take it this is a general survey across the country, not in Florida, not in this area, and nothing like that.
There's also discussion in that document, I believe, about the changing nature and use of these properties, such that older establishments with that many parking spaces per restaurant are running out of parking, which was one of the reasons the Corps gave for permitting additional parking for newly built restaurants. I also do believe there's a document in the record, and I apologize, I can't give the citation, I'll give it to you on rebuttal, that does talk about a higher range of parking spaces, up to 20, being needed, and that was also part of the
Okay, if you could find that out before rebuttal, that'd be great. I'm sorry, go ahead.
And I would like to point out, as to all of this, this does go, of course, to one of the many issues that the Corps had to contemplate as it was minimizing the alternative that it had decided. But all of this is just one factor of determining whether the overall approval of the project was arbitrary and capricious. And this Court very well might not believe that the exact number of parking spaces permitted was the exact number necessary based on the evidence before the Court. But certainly the Court's interpretation of the evidence before it was not arbitrary or capricious. And the Corps' obligation is to
provide. The definition of arbitrary and capricious includes responding to a significant comment. And the question is whether this, I guess, is a significant comment, and we decide that kind of question every day.
Well, that response to a significant comment is a NEPA obligation to respond to public comments. This is a little bit different. This
Well, no, it's not only, it's not a NEPA obligation. It's an obligation under State Farm's explanation of what arbitrary and capricious means, to fail to respond to an important oppositional statement in the record, evidence in the record that goes the other way, is to act arbitrarily and capriciously.
Yes, but this is not that type of comment. This was one piece of evidence before the Corps in making a determination about how many parking spaces to allow a regional mall to develop. And it did consider that evidence, although it did not address it explicitly, as Your Honor pointed out. And it does provide a reasoned explanation for its final decision as to how many parking spaces were necessary. And that is the Corps' obligation. If the matter of parking had simply been ignored by the Corps, then of course it would have failed to meet even the low standard of State Farm and would have been arbitrary and capricious. But frankly, having discussed parking to the extent that it did and having addressed those impacts and having brought the number of spaces down from what was originally asked for by the developer, and to that extent I should point out that this entire project had half of the acreage of wetlands impacts on site, then compared to what the developer had originally proposed, they came to the Corps with a project that would have impacted 103.7 acres of wetlands on this property. The Corps asked them to remove a big residential piece of it, to reconfigure the stormwater ponds, and got that impact down to just over 50. So the Corps,
of course, if that were the rule, from now on, every developer would ask for twice as much as the right amount. And then you could come in and say, gee, look what we did.
Which is why we're not defending it on the basis of 50% improvement, Your Honor.
on this issue of responding to comments, an argument is made by the plaintiffs here that despite the drop in market values of real estate, the Corps stuck with the 2006 valuation, and they go on to argue that there are various other elements of the original assessment which are changed in the light of new developments, and I didn't see a statement of the Corps reconciling that arguable anomaly.
There's not a statement addressing that in the record, Your Honor. The Corps didn't see that as a contradiction. The Corps' responsibility on remand, once it suspended the permit, was to address raising new information that had resulted from the discharges that the Corps detected and that it enforced against, and it did so. Of course, as it had that process ongoing for a year and a half, it did also revisit other questions. It reinitiated consultation with the Fish and Wildlife Service to reconsider impacts on the species. And it did revisit this question of how to determine what the cost of the various alternatives was. And it submitted all of the information before it, plus a great deal of additional economic information to its socioeconomic branch, which produced the review that was the basis for the Corps' final supplemental statement of findings. But the plaintiffs attempt to create a contradiction because they say that the specific fair market value of the property was different. And of course, we don't have a 2009 appraisal. We don't know that, but that's something we might speculate.
Given the real estate market at the time, right. That's not really describable as speculation.
Well, the socioeconomic branch of the Corps did say in the report that the Tampa market was somewhat different, and that you couldn't draw the inference from the National Depression that commercial real estate in this region was necessarily depressed.
Yes, that strikes me as the worst part of the answer. It's not just that you didn't answer. It's that you gave what seems to me almost an incomprehensible answer. I'm going to read it to you. It says that the crash will likely result in a significant decrease in real estate prices and a significant decrease in demand for newly constructed developments, including a significant decrease in retail consumer spending. These phenomena, however, are largely dependent upon localized market conditions. The new Tampa area may react very differently over the next year than other areas of the state and the country. Now, as to that, I think that on the face, most people would not think that Florida did better in the recession, particularly in the real estate recession, than did the rest of the country. So to simply say that it may react differently doesn't seem like a particularly obvious or common sense thing to say without some evidence. It then went on and said, moreover, recessions over time are often a time when creative destruction is put to its best uses. Well, that may be so, but the creative destruction of the real estate market in Florida, which only from reading the newspapers appears to have happened, would reduce substantially the value of the land as a market value, and which is the argument you're making generally, that we should look at market value and not the cost that the real estate developer paid. So how is this, which is the only answer to Judge Williams' question, that is, why didn't they consider the changed value? This is the only answer that is actually given by the Corps. Why isn't that arbitrary and capricious?
Because it is an answer to a question that doesn't indicate illegality or some deficiency in the Corps' determination. There are a number of determinations through this process, including all of the market surveys that the developer had to go through before it could approach the Corps initially with a project that it declared was viable. That occurred previously in time, and the Corps' responsibility between 2007 and 2009 was merely to supplement the record in response to things that had changed since the original permit was issued.
Right, so I think they could have said what you just said. They could have said, this is a moving target, it's too hard for us to reevaluate every time we go back, but they didn't say that. Instead, they said, well, we think that Florida's actually going to have a great real estate boom compared to the rest of the country, and besides, creative destruction is good.
But that description of the possibility of a boom, which as uncommonsensical as it sounds to us, none of
wait
us are real estate
didn't say
experts.
Tampa, not Florida?
They did say the new Tampa
might
era.
Be a lot different than South Florida.
And all of this goes to why it is that it is not the council's responsibility or the court's responsibility to individually weigh technical evidence. It's just to look at what evidence was before the Corps and ask whether the Corps' ultimate conclusions were reasonable. But the Corps' response to that particular...
And maybe my recollection has deceived me here. The Corps also responded that, assuming the real estate values went down, real estate rentals would probably follow them down, and therefore you would be off on a much more complex inquiry.
That's correct. Thank you, Your Honor, for bringing that up. And I also would add that another reason...
I'm sorry, when you come back on rebuttal, if you could tell me the page so I could find that.
Yes, Your Honor, I will. And another reason that is not in that review but is an important thing to consider is that this would not have been resolved by simply substituting the 2006 fair market value with the 2009 fair market value. It would have required substitution of all of the economic data before the Corps as of that year. And so that would have been a major undertaking that no one deemed necessary and so the Corps reasonably decided it was unnecessary and continued to reach its same conclusion. It did, however, press the developers pretty hard on the specific rate of return that was the result of all these calculations we're debating. And I just want to counter the inference made by the plaintiffs on the side that the developers announced the amount of profit they wanted to make and that the Corps accepted that. I mean, as late as February 2009, the Corps was pushing back on this idea of an 8% rate of return and required additional information and corrected information and finally was persuaded and attempted to explain that in some detail in a supplemental statement of findings.
I want to ask you one more question about responses to the record evidence. This is with respect to the ESA and maybe therefore also with respect to the EIS, which is the indigo snake. So I understand the argument, the response that we didn't see any snakes. But you have this declaration from Dr. Dodd, who nobody seems to dispute is the world's foremost expert on indigo snakes, and used to work for FWS, who said that the problem is destroying the snake's habitat and fragmenting the sort of corridor from one habitat to another, and that the principal reason for the disappearance of the snake, or the potential disappearance of the snake, is the increasing development of land by developers. I didn't see a response at all, really. Not even really. I didn't see a response to this problem of the destruction of the corridor, of the fragmentation of its habitat. I did see an argument that there currently were no snakes on the property. What's the answer to that? Why isn't it important that they didn't respond to Dodd's argument about destruction of habitat?
Well, because for similar reasons, Your Honor, the question is whether the Corps' finding and then the Fish and Wildlife Service's concurrence in that finding was ultimately reasonable. And so they did give the reason, of course, that there were no snakes viewed. During reinitiation, the Corps did submit to the service the affidavit of the naturalist who canoed down the river and claims he did see a snake, so that was also considered. But the Corps' assessment of impacts on species that was originally submitted to the Fish and Wildlife Service, it does mention that there is still some natural connection between this project and other projects. The service's recovery plan for the indigo snake indicates that the indigo snake has done very well in suburban settings and often can be seen sunning itself on pavement. All of these things were in the record, and while not explicitly discussed in the Fish and Wildlife Service's concurrence letter, were certainly sent to the service. The service acknowledges receipt of it and discusses that.
Well, acknowledging receipt, if the rule were acknowledging receipt of a comment, that would sort of wipe out the requirement to respond to significant comments.
But the requirement for the service is not to respond to all comments. The requirement to the service is to make a reasoned judgment about whether this project is likely to adversely affect the species.
Right. So when you come up on rebuttal, give me the best pages from the JA where they address the question of habitat for that snake, and particularly if they do it all, the question of the use of this area as a corridor for its passage between one habitat and another.
I will, Your Honor. I'll bring that back. I see my time has expired, so.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll give you some time for rebuttal.
Good morning. Eric Lichtenstein on behalf of Sierra Club appellees. Beginning with the parking lot issue raised by Judge Garland, important to stress that the comments that were referred to were not comments in this particular instance that were solicited by the plaintiffs from some particular chosen expert of theirs. Unfortunately, all the plaintiffs' chosen experts, although their qualifications were never disputed, were essentially ignored by the court. But in this particular instance, these letters were solicited specifically by Sierra Properties. You take a look at them in the joint appendix at some point. Beginning on page 603 is one letter, and then continuing 606. These are letters from people who were solicited precisely because they were major real estate developers and mall developers in the Tampa area. And they then provided their opinion as to the amount of parking that was needed for a mall like this one. And they were submitted to the Corps by the developer as indicative of how much parking would be necessary for a project exactly like this one. So this is not some stray piece of information we're complaining the court didn't respond to.
Can we go back on that? I mean, I'm looking at 604. What has been your experience regarding the parking requirements of anchor tenants? Actually, the answer that would respond to the rest of the question. The anchor tenants would, I take it, not include the restaurants. Would that be right? Would seem to be the most parking-intensive use.
Right. Your Honor, my understanding, and this is terms of art, obviously, that have been bandied back and forth, is that this was providing an answer based upon the description of the kind of project that's at issue here.
I'm just looking at the question that produces the estimate 4.5 to 5 per 1,000 feet.
Well,
it may be that generally it was framed in terms of the project, but that particular question was framed in terms of anchor tenants.
Right. And what I would say is that if you look back up at the top of the letter, there's a description of what a typical new mall encompasses in terms of the tenants that would be there. It refers to department store, cinema, the mall around the area. And I guess all I would say, Your Honor, is that this is exactly the kind of point that the Corps should have responded to in the record, where they didn't say that we're not relying upon those particular letters because they're irrelevant for some reason. And these were materials that were specifically solicited by the developer itself, and it seems that it was critical to provide.
There were other data, right, relating to higher estimates of parking needs.
Well, Your Honor, what they said was that some of these other malls were not comparable, although they also didn't respond to evidence in the record that, in fact, they are comparable. And I would ask you at some point to take a look at JA 572, where they themselves conceded that there was a comparison with other malls. JA 249, their own consultant, referred to these other malls as being recently developed malls, the same kinds of malls that are being referred to in these letters. So the part of the response was, well, we have a much bigger mall and we have somewhat different needs. Elsewhere in the record, they referred to the fact that these other malls were comparable. And I think it's also important to stress that even a slight reduction in the 14,000 spaces of parking would have enormous benefits in terms of wetland reduction, which is, of course, exactly what the statutory scheme is supposed to be about. The Corps itself said that a downsizing by a mere 5% would free 21.7 acres that could be used for site reconfiguration to reduce wetlands impacts, reduce impervious surfaces, preclude alteration of the buffer adjacent to Cypress Creek, allow for restoration of the buffer along Cypress Creek, and provide for more on-site mitigation.
What's the JA site for that?
Your Honor, this one is cited in our brief. Unfortunately, I don't have the JA site.
The page from the brief?
Hopefully my counsel can find that for
me. Sorry, you can tell us at the end.
So we think this was a crucial issue that was not adequately responded to. And in addition to this, Judge Garland had a discussion with counsel for the government relating to the one other piece of evidence, which is the comparison to a particular kind of mall called the Lifestyle Center. And in fact, if you look at that citation for the Lifestyle Center, this is referred to in footnote 19 of our brief. What it actually makes quite clear is that kind of lifestyle center not only talks about an average of parking, but it talks about catering to affluent residential neighborhoods. This is the citation for this is JA 673, and it compares lifestyle centers to malls. And our clients went out of their way to point out that a mall like this one, this huge regional mall, is not the same thing as what was described with the lifestyle center. So I think at best what you have here is the failure of the Corps to clearly explain what it acknowledged was a huge concern, which was the extraordinary amount of wetlands that had to be taken up for a vast amount of parking. Now, if I can turn to the question about the 2006 versus 2009 valuation, which Judge Williams was asking about, the fact of the matter is, Your Honors, this is another issue in which plaintiffs, the Sierra Club below, and its cohorts made an extraordinary effort to put information into the record, specifically identifying not only the general drop in real estate prices throughout the country and in Florida, but in the Tampa area in particular. And they highlighted information which there was no dispute about, that there was a drop-off in real estate prices in the area. And there was simply no response to it. The only response, as Judge Garland was discussing with government counsel, was a non-response, which was maybe Tampa will be different, without articulating.
Can I ask your co-counsel also look for the JA site for the drop in the real estate in the Tampa area that you put into the record?
Comments. Yes, Your Honor.
The court didn't mention what I thought they had mentioned, which was the likely parallel drop in rentals, therefore making the re-inquiry a good deal more complicated than what the Sierra Club was proposing.
Your Honor, I don't recall the court ever saying
that. It seems obvious, even if they didn't say it.
I don't recall the court saying that, Your Honor. What I will say is that they sort of seem to acknowledge that there was a pertinent issue here. And in fact, it's ironic for them to say, well, there would be a new reanalysis because a new appraisal was submitted to the record before the 2009 permit decision. But it was this rather strange retrospective appraisal of what the values would have been in 2006. So their claim that it was a difficulty in putting in a new appraisal doesn't make a lot of sense. They actually had a company do a new appraisal. They simply put one in that was claimed to be retrospective of 2006. But I think the more important point, Your Honor, in terms of your questions about updating the analysis and the new analysis, is that when they were putting out their public notice, it was not a situation, I think as suggested by government counsel, that all they were asking for was information about these repeated illegal discharges from the site. They specifically in the public notices in this Joint Appendix 1547 said that they wanted comments on the whole range of issues that might be relevant to whether they should maintain the permit, revoke the permit, which they had clear authority to do. And they specifically said, told the public, that they would review proposed modifications unrelated to the circumstances that gave rise to the permit suspension. And on a host of issues, and we summarize these in our brief, page 38, they in fact did consider new evidence. They considered new evidence relating to the amount of mitigation that would be arguably necessary. They considered new information related to woodstork impacts.
Step back a moment. Let's hypothesize that the Corps said what I thought it said, namely that rentals would probably flow down more or less in parallel with the capital value of the land. First, let's do it assuming they said that. Is that not a very reasonable response? I mean, I understand that rental values and capital values don't always track as tidily as one might expect, but putting aside that necessary qualification, wouldn't that be a fairly good answer?
I don't think it would, Your Honor, because the prior analysis was based upon rather detailed statements made by the company as to the amount it was using in its valuation calculations. And if you look at
those are estimated rentals, right? I mean, the whole capitalization bit is taking projected rentals and capitalizing it at some rate.
Right, Your Honor. But I guess what I'm saying is, instead of just saying, well, you know, these things are going to go down, so maybe those other values would go down too, I think what it would call for
wouldn't a big, perhaps the almost exclusive reason for the capital value to go down be that the projected rentals were going to go down? Unless there's a change in the capitalization rate, which is possible.
Right, Your Honor. But of course, that begs the question as to whether a project of this magnitude would be viable at all, because this entire project was based upon an assumption as to the number of people who would use various retail services. And if you wouldn't have those kind of rental returns because people aren't basically even using them, then you could theoretically cut out at least some of the huge number of restaurants or some of the retail space. So I think Your Honor actually raises what I think is an even more important overarching question, which is some level of analysis as to whether a project that was justified on the grounds that we had a roaring economy that was going to basically allow the creation or facilitate the creation of this massive new town center could be scaled back at all. So I think once you start going down that road, this is the problem with what the Corps did. It's a little bit pregnant problem. They started looking at some new information, particularly when it was of benefit to the developer. But when we put in new information that went to some other parts of the equation and the methodology, these simply got ignored. And I think that's really a fundamental APA problem.
Incidentally, I didn't see a citation in your brief of where it is in the record that you ask the Corps to use an updated capital value for the property. You say you did, but I didn't see a record citation.
Your Honor, this is discussed in our brief beginning at page 36. We have citations to the joint appendix where we submitted copious evidence demonstrating that commercial real estate prices had dropped precipitously in recent years. We have quite a few pages. A number of those are quite specific to Florida, I believe specific to the Tampa area. And then we have the response from the socioeconomics branch cited at JA 1661. And then our discussion goes on for several pages about how the Corps had considered various new kinds of developments but had studiously avoided responding to this one when it made the 2009 decision. So I think, Your Honor, with those citations and those pages, I believe, will be where – well, I think one way at page 36, where we joint appendix 1585 through 1638 and 1594 – are the copious articles and other materials we submitted at the time discussing the decrease in values in the Florida area. So I think that's where you would find that discussion. If I could spend just a short time on the snake issue that was raised by Judge Garland, because I think this is another example of where we don't just have plaintiffs fly-specking. We have plaintiffs going out of their way to submit, I think, a rather extraordinary level of detail to the agency that simply wasn't responded to. And in this particular case, we have the declaration of Dr. Dodd, which begins at page 1301 of the joint appendix and ends at page 19, summarizing his views on page 137, whose expertise not only is not questioned, this is the person who wrote the rule listing the snake as a threatened species, who co-wrote the recovery plan, who was the herpetologist for the federal government for years, if not decades. He puts in a 20-page declaration, which identifies a myriad of ways in which there could be harm to the snake, forgetting about whether you happen to see one on a site. And incidentally, we also have a declaration from an individual never discussed at all in the record, who says that I was canoeing down the Cypress Creek, the outstanding Florida water, and I saw an indigo snake go from the river, from the creek, up onto the site in exactly the place they would expect to be discovered, which is near these gopher tortoise holes. And we have the expert on the species saying it could be killed by increased road traffic in the area, it won't be usable as a travel corridor, there is habitat loss, which is cumulative, that isn't being mitigated for at all under this approach. Not a word is said about his declaration by either the Corps or the Fish and Wildlife Service. Now, if the shoe were on the other foot and we had the Corps denying a permit to a developer and they had gone out and gotten a 20-page single-spaced, closely spaced declaration from a leading expert on a species saying this problem is completely illusory and nothing was said about it, you could be darn sure they would in here, which I would think would be a very strong APA argument that there's got to be something said about these concerns in the record by the relevant agencies. I respectfully submit the answer can't be different because it's people who are concerned about the impacts on the project. And let me, if I could just take one moment to finish with this, Your Honor. I understand that there are huge concerns about people not coming into court after they haven't given agencies full opportunities to address various issues. I believe in this case, these plaintiffs really went the extra mile to put their concerns before the court. And I think the flip side of principles we derive from Vermont Yankee and many of this court's cases are when there are those kinds of concerns, the agency has to say something about them in the record. On crucial issues, that didn't happen, and I respectfully submit it supports the ruling that we received below and the other concerns we've laid out. Thank you.
I tell you, Mr. McFadden did not have any time. We'll give you 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I owe Your Honor some record citations on the question of restaurant parking. You can look at JA 655, which is a response by the developers to questions on this issue by the Corps, which it explains that 15 spaces per 1,000 square feet is consistent with the parking standards required by neighboring urban environments such as Hillsborough County. So while it exceeds that required by Pasco County, it's more than the law requires. It's consistent with the minimum required by neighboring jurisdictions, and then on the next
page. I'm not sure what the relevance of the requirement of a different jurisdiction is.
It's relevant to suggest the need for that amount of parking for a particular type of use. If a jurisdiction requires no less parking than that.
Is that a more urban jurisdiction? Is that one where the people in the neighborhood would otherwise be complaining about traffic on the parking on their streets, that sort of thing? That's normally the reason. This certainly isn't that kind of area.
Well, this is less urban than that area, yeah, to be sure. But traffic concerns were also a grave concern to Pasco County for this project. And while that's not part of the answer in the number of parking spaces, to the extent that that goes into your honors consideration, it's worth looking at. The next page goes on to say that 15 to 20 spaces per 1,000 square feet is a matter of typical need for restaurants specifically. And this same two pages of the record describes that neighboring malls that were used as the basis of comparison are running out of parking space and suggests that they wish that they did, in fact, build more at the beginning, which goes to the question of whether this is a lifestyle center. This project is proposed to have the same commercial makeup as those lifestyle centers described at JA 673, and so that composition is what was proposed to be built. It's not something that is at issue before this court, and the Corps is entitled by its own regulations, 33 CFR 320.4Q, which is part of the Corps' compliance with the Cooling Water Act, to presume that the developer knows whether its proposal is going to be viable for its own private purposes and whether it is going to be able to accommodate what the market would bear.
Did your research while your opposing counsel was speaking develop whether I just completely invented this response of the Corps on the updating issue?
I did not come up with the page.
Did not come up,
but it does sound familiar to me. So I did not, we may both have independently
maybe it's so
invented it.
Obvious that it would come up.
With respect to the indigo snake and its habitat, this is discussed in the original environmental assessment and finding of no significant impact, JA 1109. It describes that the necessary habitat and the necessary linkage to other habitat for the snake is the wetlands themselves. It needs access to Cypress Creek, and that will be preserved because most of the wetlands it needs for travel through the site are preserved. Only some portion of wetland J will be filled, and the project also requires building some form of bridge, which will serve as a wildlife corridor, not just for the snake, but for other wildlife, I believe, over and across the property and Cypress Creek. So this question of whether or not habitat fragmentation is such a severe impact on the species as to adversely affect it and require formal consultation was in fact addressed.
This 1109, it's not about snakes though, is it?
That's the page number I wrote down, I'm sorry.
No, it is about wildlife linkage. It doesn't tell me what kind of wildlife we're talking about.
It's about the critical wildlife linkage.
I don't know if snakes go over bridges or not, but it seems unlikely to me.
Well, this snake travels. The recovery plan indicates it might travel 100 miles in a straight line on its search for food and shelter. It's a mover. And so it might very well, if it crosses parking lots, as the Fish and Wildlife Service has said that it does, it might very well cross the bridge as well.
I'm looking at the pages. I don't see. I see mice. I see gophers. I see alligators. I see frogs.
This is the discussion. Obviously, the discussion of the indigo snake specifically and its impacts are on a different page. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, we'll get it. It's all right.
Yeah. But at any rate, this addresses the question of whether habitat was considered and critical wildlife linkage, which I should point out is something that only has state law meaning. It's not a federal law phrase. Whether it was considered and preserved, and the answer is that it was.
Okay. Other questions?
Okay. Thank you,
we'll
Your Honor.
Take this under submission. Oh yes. Sorry, please. But now you have to remind us what it's a citation for.
This is the citation. I think you had asked for small amount of reduction in parking could have a huge
yes,
benefit.
Yes. Yeah.
JA 572 through 73, and JA 1083 through 84.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.